Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Hello, welcome to a special edition JAPA podcast, and we have a very special guest today. Chris and I both loved an article from the June 2019 edition that was written by our special guest, also named Chris, but Chris Everett. So Chris Everett, lead author of that article, is here with us today. Chris, can you tell us, one, a little bit about yourself, two, the title of the article, which I haven't mentioned yet.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll start with the title of the article. It's Primary Care Provider Type. Are there differences in patients' intermediate diabetes outcomes? So I am not Chris Everett, the tennis player. I feel like I always have to start by saying that, just to make sure everybody has the right expectations. So I'm an associate professor at Duke. I am a PA, but I am also a health services researcher. And I study healthcare teams and how to design healthcare teams in order to get the best outcomes for patients and organizations. What else can I tell you about myself? I am also the director of the clinical research unit for my department, which is family medicine and community health. I also have a secondary appointment in the Department of Population Health Sciences. And I am soon to become an empty nester. So I'm very excited about that.
Ah, okay. That is exciting. Mm-hmm. So basically you don't sleep too much.
Correct.
But maybe some sleep is coming up. Awesome. You've been working in this realm of research for a little while. Why did you specifically take on this research study and in this population?
Sure. So in health services research, I think we all are always chasing the really policy relevant questions. And at this particular era, right, everybody's talking about value-based payment and how do you transform healthcare in order to, you know, deliver really high quality care, improve access and reduce costs. And, you know, and so of course, everybody's coming to the recognition that nobody can do it by themselves. And so teams are becoming really hot. And in my estimation, and I'm sure a lot of people will agree with me, primary care is kind of the place to start because most policy wonks would tell you that primary care is really, having a really firm primary care system is sort of the bedrock of having a very efficient healthcare system. So that's why I got into teams and primary care. Of course, you know, because everybody's talking about how do you do it well and do it efficiently, PAs and nurse practitioners are the next statement out of everyone's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we decided to do this. I had done a study similar to this previously in a different system in a large academic medical healthcare system in the Midwest. But we really wanted to do this in the VA because it's really ideal. One, the VA is the largest employer of PAs in the country. Two, they have very complex patients for the given age group of the patients, right? They tend to be like the equivalent of 10 years older. So super complex patients. You don't really have to deal with issues of state scope of practice because they follow the federal supremacy rule. So everybody, all the PAs and NPs have the same scope of practice. And they were, the VA actually was right at the forefront of doing the patient-centered medical home. And the way they did the patient-centered medical home allowed PAs and nurse practitioners to be the clinician leads of their different teams. So it was kind of an ideal situation and taking advantage of natural experiment in order to do this study.
So obviously with your background in looking into developing teams and how do you put together a efficient and cohesive team? How did you put together your team of co-authors to help tackle this topic?
Sure. I wish I could take credit, but I cannot. I was actually invited onto this team. So George Jackson is the PI in the Veterans Health Administration. So he is also a health services researcher, epidemiologist. He is not a clinician. And he had done a study before about PAs and NPs, and of course he's very interested in organizational design. He and Perry Morgan, who Perry Morgan's my other half here at Duke, at the Duke Research Group, started talking about trying to basically use the same methodology that I had previously used in that Midwestern Academic Medical Center and to apply it to the VA data. So I got invited on really mostly because of my methodology experience, and they were kind enough to let me first author this paper. But it's one of several. One of the other papers was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and then the cost paper just got published in Health Affairs.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Just to summarize, if you haven't gone back to the article and you're listening so far, this research used data from the Veterans Health Administration to look at differences in diabetes outcomes that might exist among patients who had different types of primary and you say and supplemental providers, so physicians, PAs, NPs.
Right.
And why don't you tell us what you found?
Sure. So just sort of to explain that distinction though, because it's a pretty important one. And in primary care, I'm sure everybody can relate to having their usual provider of care or their PCP or primary care provider.
Right.
So that's sort of the main role in primary care for providers, right? So you are the one who is responsible for delivering the majority of their care and coordinating all their specialty services.
Right, right.
So, however, there is another role that's kind of the sleeper role that many people don't talk about too much, and that's the supplemental provider. So, you know, the goal in primary care is always to try to get patients to see their primary care provider. But given that the panel sizes for patients is so large, you know, and providers want to take vacations every once in a while. That's a nice thing too, right? So, you know, so inevitably people wind up seeing a primary care provider that's not their usual provider, right? And so that group, you know, who provides some, but a minority of the primary care is what we term supplemental providers. So those are the two roles that, that any clinician, a doctor, a PA, or a nurse practitioner can perform within primary care and often do. So any given panel of patients, depending on the organization, I've seen a panel served by anywhere from an average of 4 to 10 providers, depending on the situation and how large the panels are and everything else. So what we wanted to do is that the paper and Annals really looked at who the usual provider. And of course, in the Annals paper, we found no differences in outcomes. And in this particular study, we wanted to see whether or not it really mattered who the supplemental providers were. Mm-hmm. Right? More and more today, we are working as teams, and you know, patients are being seen by multiple primary care clinicians. And so we wanted to really know if there was any influence on whether or not it mattered what the supplemental providers were.
And I see.
Yeah. And so ultimately what we found was there was no clinically significant difference, right? So if you look at the tables, you'll see that there are some things that are statistically significant, but because it is such a large study sample, it's over 600,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, you'll get a very small difference being statistically significant because so that's what we found, no real differences. And what this study did as well, which I have not really seen in any studies like it, is that we actually saw a group of patients that had PA primary care providers, so usual providers of care with no physician involvement. Mm-hmm. And we also saw a group that had NP PCPs with no physician involvement. So that was also a pretty cool and new, unique finding. And again, there was no difference in the outcomes for those patients either.
Awesome. That's great. So when you're looking at like primary care provider of record, and then basically anyone who has had a touch point with a patient in their care, still in both of the studies, no clinically significant difference.
Correct.
Depending on who was the care provider. And so we love that as PAs, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
So as you're sort of digesting this and have been chewing on it for a while now, was there anything in particular that surprised you?
Well, it did surprise me a little bit, because to tell you the truth, in the last study that I did in that large academic institution, we did see differences based on the supplemental provider. So I really was anticipating to see something very similar again. So it sort of leads me to believe, and again, this is sort of outside the scope of the study, mm-hmm. But you know, every good study leads you to ask 20 more questions. So it leads me to believe that there just might be something about the organization and their process or their culture, you know, that really makes the difference between seeing differences in outcomes depending on, you know, who's touching the patient. So,
well, and that piggybacks off of, you know, one of the other comments that we, or our bullet points of what we wanted to talk about was, you know, how this knowledge can, you know, add to the PA profession or medicine in general. And sort of I'm looking at it as, you know, the PA profession was born out of the military. This is obviously a veterans, you know, administration centered study where we are interacting with military personnel. And the culture there, it seems to be just much more, I don't want to say supportive, because it kind of downplays, you know, major medical centers and some of the other things, but it's just the history is there. And seeing these data helps, at least in my mind, show what we as, you know, advanced practice providers or whatever our colloquial term for PAs and MPs are, in how we can fit into this model and how to improve patient care within a vast, vast patient set. Would you think that's a fair assessment to make?
I do. I absolutely do. And I think, you know, and I find it really interesting, because I'm not a provider in the VA, so I will throw that out there now. But the VA in particular, I find so fascinating, because I think that it gets such a bad rap in the press. You know, but actually, of the healthcare systems in the US, they have dedicated so many resources to try to improve the processes. And if you would have known about the VA in the 80s, you know, in the 1980s, and what it is now, I mean, it has just moved mountains. And they work so hard to build the structures around the teams and the clinicians and the patients to really get the best outcomes that they can in a very cost-effective way, right? They do not have they don't have the profit motive, right, that many other systems do in the US. So it's just such an interesting culture that really is, again, embedded in that sort of military philosophy, you know, that I think there's a whole lot that a lot of systems can learn from them.
Mm-hmm. I'll pipe up here and say that while I didn't work for the VA, my paycheck didn't come from them. I was kind of a contractor and worked fully within the VA system, mm-hmm. saw only veterans, used only the VA system. And I can speak to that personally. There is a very step-by-step methodologic approach that's evidence-based to why we're making decisions, what's most cost-effective and what's best for the patient going through. And the people there as care providers truly care about the patient population. And you hear, like Christine, like you said, you hear different things in the news, but having the bird's eye view, the insider's perspective, like you just said, I think that there's a real focus on patient care and taking care of our country's veterans. And then this standardization in kind of practices, which, you know, you said this is not one of the primary outcomes or things that you looked at, but that standardization across the board and how they go through their policies and procedures and what's the next step in care and why we're following this kind of flow chart. I can see explaining some of the patterns that you saw with this research. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is anything in particular that you hope that this work gets used for? Can you see like the direct application or what types of maybe policies or steps forward you could see this paper being cited for?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I definitely think it supports the idea that, you know, PAs and NPs can be PCPs to a pretty complicated group of patients. very complex, medically complex and socially complex group of patients, right?
Yes.
So the thing that I would be wary of course, this is only looking at diabetes patients, so you can't extrapolate it to everything. Certainly more studies need to be done. But I think it's a really important step forward, this paper paired with the Annals paper, and then paired with the cost paper that came out in Health Affairs that demonstrated that PAs and NPs actually deliver care that's less costly than physicians. So I think all of that wrapped up together, I think can help organizations feel better about exactly what the top of the license means for PAs. I would, though, again, be super careful about that. The one thing that makes me super nervous is extrapolating that to all PAs, right? We know that PAs get very little formal training, that we have a pretty large educational learning curve, right, when we first came out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And because the VA has employed so many PAs, and really since the beginning of the PA profession, there are some exceptionally skilled and experienced PAs in the VA system.
Right.
We did not have access to that information. So mm-hmm. ideally, I would have loved to have done this study where I could have said this PA had 10 years of experience and this doctor had 2 years of experience and this NP had 7 years of experience.
That's a great point.
Yeah, but we couldn't do that.
Right.
And so you hope for the best. My concern as an educator, in particular, is I sort of am acutely aware of where brand new PAs are.
Yes.
And so I always caution, that yes, PAs can do this, but is it PAs who've been doing this for 5 years, or is it a PA who's just coming out of school? And, given the complexity of primary care, I just would caution, I would have that word of caution, is that not all PAs are exactly the same, so...
And speaking to other fellow PA educators, Adrian and I have had conversations over the years that mirror that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also points back to the level of support, administration support within mm-hmm. the system that you're practicing in.
Right.
You might be a new graduate going into a VA, but you are supported by that system, which is a lot different than being hired as a new graduate and getting put out in a rural clinic somewhere where you don't have any physician oversight and you're expected to then manage these patients all by yourself without that level of support from the administration. So mm-hmm. I agree. I think the trepidation in extrapolating that into the general PA population, should sit back and say, well, we need to look at some things before we just go full steam ahead. I think it's great data and I think it's a great outlook on the profession, but you're right. Sitting back and just having pause about how this can be applied is certainly prudent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'd like to back out and take kind of a big picture look at research now a little bit, if that's okay, and just ask, stepping away from the specifics of your research, what do you like about being a PA researcher in general?
Oh, yes. I can tell you both. I really love being a researcher because I think I'm just such a curious person. And so, to be allowed the time to really formulate these questions and design a study and to be able to carry it out and then interpret it and write it up is such a cool way to spend your time. I talk to a lot of PA students actually and PhD students and I work a lot, but it doesn't feel like it because I really love doing it. That being said, of the scientific process, I think writing papers is my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm strange because I love to write grants, but I hate writing papers because by the time we're at the paper stage, I'm over it. I know the answer.
I do know.
But the grant is the really creative part, so I love doing that. So writing is a love-hate relationship for me. I love that I have written, but I generally don't enjoy the process.
That's really nice to hear you say. It's kind of comforting.
Yeah, and I think to piggyback off of the whole team approach, I think that's where you can, if you get yourself into a nice research team where you have somebody who likes to write the grant and somebody who likes to do the methodology and the literature review, and maybe you like somebody who enjoys actually writing the paper to make it digestible, you spread that out, you play to everybody's strengths, everybody gets to do the things that they love to do, and the end product is a really good research product that is then contributing to the data at large.
Oh, absolutely. And we had such a fantastic team for this VA study. It was really literally a joy. And we're already trying to write another grant, so hopefully for next summer, using more VA data. So it's, yeah. And I don't know, I honestly don't know how anybody does this kind of research without a team. It is really such a challenging thing. It's funny, during my training, a lot of people used to tease me because I love secondary data analysis, and some people sort of see that as a lesser thing because you're not collecting your own data. But I got to tell you, secondary data, it's a wild beast, and you never know what you're going to get. And so in a lot of ways, it's harder. I mean, I've done both, and I actually find the secondary data analysis more challenging, but I like it better.
That's a good point, because it already exists. You don't have control over what data is there with secondary analysis. Exactly. As the person who didn't set out to collect it. And there's so much out there. There's so much data that exists already that we need to look at. Well, you're definitely a role model for me. We sat next to each other at a luncheon recently, and of course I've read your name 1,000 times, but I had never met you in person. So I stuck my hand out. I'm Adrienne Banny. You're like, "Hi, I'm Chris Everett." And I almost passed out. I was a little starstruck.
which now you're making me blush.
Well, luckily it's a podcast, so we can't tell. But I wonder if you have any advice for those thinking about getting more involved in research. Your passion is obviously there and a little bit contagious. Someone wants to start in this. What would you suggest to them?
Oh, absolutely. And I do love research. And actually, that's my career goal, is to make sure that I replace myself with at least 5 people.
Wow.
I do think the profession needs many more researchers. I would say, if somebody hasn't done research and is a PA and wants to start doing that, to absolutely find somebody like me. My email is splashed all over the place. You just have to go to the Duke PA website and you'll find me. But like me or Perry Morgan or Rod Hooker, and find somebody who does research and does research similar to what you want to do, and pick their brains. And there's not that many of us, so we're all pretty intimately connected. So if we can't help you directly, we can help you find somebody who can. So that would be my first piece of advice. The second piece of advice, because trying to start out and do it all by yourself without a mentor who knows kind of what they're doing is pretty painful. So I wouldn't advise that. But the other thing that I would tell you, is think about taking some classes. I mean, NIH has some free online stuff about just basics, about study design. See what you can do that way. If you're really serious about it and want to start getting into degrees, that's a really smart thing to do. I think what we're going to try to do here at Duke is write a training grant within the next few years to try to get a joint PA PhD, and the PhD would be in population health sciences. So we're trying to make the path a little bit easier for those that come after us, because mine was certainly circuitous and a little bit all over the place. I would say that the outlook is looking good. I would say if you can just get over that initial hurdle of just sending someone an email, because some people, they sort of think, oh, they're not going to respond. Oh, we will. We're all super passionate about this. And I talk to a lot of people every week, and try to help people down whatever path it is they want. So there's so many opportunities, and I think that's only going to increase as time goes on here.
Well, thank you so much. I can definitely vouch for how friendly everyone has been. And, you know, someday if you find yourself sitting next to one of these storied researchers, you should just stick your hand out and see if maybe they'll be on your podcast or help you out. Professional growth.
Exactly. Yes and yes. We will.
Well, Chris Everett, thank you so much for being here today. I just want to remind everyone that we're talking about the article, Primary Care Provider Type, Are There Differences in Patients' Intermediate Diabetes Outcomes? And that's by primary author that we have here today, Christine Everett, and then Perry Morgan, Valerie Smith, Sandra Wilson, David Edelman, Christina Hendricks, Theodore Berkowitz, Brandilyn White, and George Jackson, which was published in the Journal of the American Academy of PAs in June 2019. So go check it out.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.